Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to start the morning doing a little running with a stroller. Then we'll open up the phones until 10. That's when our next WDEV All-Star joins us, and we get to meet the man behind the weather, Roger Hill. And we'll finish the morning with the acclaimed poetry of Laura Bedofsky-Wisniewski. But first, if necessity is the mother of invention, it's time to meet the mom who invented out of necessity. There are a lot of great strollers built for you to run with, but what was really needed was that something that made those strollers easy to run with. And thus, we have the Stroll Runner. Joining me now is its creator, Heather Hayes. Heather, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Heather about her creation or to share how you've been running with the Stroll Runner, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Heather, you better explain what the Stroll Runner is.
So basically, Stroll Runner is an accessory for jogging strollers that allows parents to run hands-free. And that's in a nutshell. I've actually been really surprised to see a multitude of different uses come out of this product that I never would have expected. Most notably, parents who are not able to otherwise push a stroller due to some sort of a medical limitation, such as being on crutches or people who maybe have lost a limb but are unable to use a prosthetic. I have a woman who uses a walker, and so this has really given them a chance to connect with their child in a way they otherwise couldn't and have some freedom of mobility to take them out and about with them. So
oh,
that's been very rewarding.
I was going to say, Heather, that's got to be so gratifying to see these other uses in addition to what was it was originally intended for.
Absolutely. I mean, this invention came from my own use of trying to jog with a stroller. I have a 14-and-a-half-year-old who was the inspiration for this, and then I also have a 4-and-a-half-month-old now. But when I first went for a jog with my daughter, my oldest, it was just a horrible experience. So I vowed to try to find something that would make it more enjoyable for running. But it's wonderful that it can also be used for walking. I can't run with my youngest right now in the stroller. A baby needs to be about 6 months old before that's a safe option for them, just because of neck stability and head and neck stability. So walking with it has been enjoyable. But I think, yes, most gratifying is seeing people being able to bring their kids out that otherwise couldn't.
Well, what are the special features of Stroll Runner that makes it work so well?
So initially, I was able to build a prototype. I've been through about 16 different iterations probably at last count.
Wow.
Before we were able to get to what I felt comfortable enough putting out into the market for people. There's a couple of different things. I actually met with biomedical engineers at the University of Vermont Medical Center early on when I was having trouble figuring out a way to allow the Stroll Runner to be worn and still be able to steer the stroller without having to put your hands on the handle. That was really the big thing, was take your hands off the handle and just have that upper body core freedom, have your hands free. I don't even like running with a water bottle in my hand, so I really wanted nothing in hand. And so they helped me to develop the pivot point, and that's there's a belly plate that goes up against the user. And then the piece that connects between the belly plate and the arm, if you will, that goes out to the stroller handle, we actually have 3D printed, so it's very flexible. And what they had suggested was having that flexion point at the body. So that allows comfort of use. And then really our secret sauce came from the last piece we developed, which is called, we call it the wheel damper. So it's a piece that attaches onto the front wheel. Typically, you would use this with a three-wheel jogging stroller. And most three-wheel jogging strollers have the ability to either have the wheel fixed into position, or you can unlock it and allow it to swivel. We needed a balance between the two. So when the wheel is locked, you have the best ability to steer the stroller because it's not going to move from side to side. Mm-hmm. But you have to put your hands on the handle, lift up the front wheel a bit to be able to turn. So we wanted to be able to unlock that front wheel, but not allow it to swivel all over the place. When you run or when you do anything with a stroller and you're pushing it forward, the pressure on the handle will lift that front wheel, even just millimeters. But it's enough throughout your gait as you're lifting it that if that wheel comes up off the ground, it can swivel in any direction it wants to. And when it lands, you're chasing it wherever it landed. So the damper allows us to give some swivel, and the user can actually choose how much of that flexibility they want to have via a bungee system. So the damper goes around the front wheel, and then bungees connect from that to the undercarriage of the stroller and again, allow it to move a little bit, but not so much that you're chasing it and only thinking about, oh, my goodness, the stroller is going to the right or it's going to the left. How am I going to get it back into the center? It really allows you to just enjoy the run.
Now, Heather, you wanted to run. You identified a problem that you had. Are you an engineer or mechanically inclined? Because I would probably stop running. But you...
I did.
How did... I mean, this is pretty incredible that you said, I can figure this out. I can create something that will make this work.
I think my strength lies in networking and connecting with people. I'm a very social person by nature, and if I want to solve something, I'm humble enough to know what I know and what I don't know. If I'm interested in it enough, I will learn about it. Engineering is definitely not a strong suit for me, so I'm more the creative idea person, and then I'm very good at seeking out those who are smarter than I am and can help me to figure out how to make something work. So the first person I reached out to was a dear friend, Scott Ross. Hopefully he's okay with me mentioning his name, but he's actually a mastermind when it comes to car restoration. And his just knowing the way his brain works, and when he sees a problem, he can fix it, or if there isn't something that exists, he will create it. He was the first person I went to with this idea and asked if he could use some of his knowledge of engineering and such to help me make at least an initial prototype. And that first prototype, you can see it on the website. It's pretty funny. We used a fox kidney belt. So it was just something that you would wear for like motocross and dirt bike racing.
All right.
We turned it around so that we would have a spot to put up against our abdomen and create things off of. And then we took two aluminum poles. Somehow he molded them onto the front of the kidney belt, and then those went out and attached to the stroller handle. So it was proof of concept, but we really played around with a lot of fun different materials. But, you know, to circle back to answer your question, I'm more the creative, but I'm pretty good at finding the people who can help bring my thoughts into tangible ideas.
Yeah, which is a big part of this. Before Stroll Runner, was there any product on the market that would do something like this?
Yeah. And you know, at first that was a scary thought for me when I did more research and found things. I thought, oh no, someone already thought of this. And then at the same time, I had to kind of flip that script in my head and think, well, then it's a problem that someone else is trying to solve. So this is a good thing.
Right.
There are two things out there on the market. Well, I shouldn't say on the market. There's one was on the market, is no longer, and another that is on the market, trying to solve the same problem. So the first one is called Stroll Smart. And had I known that that was the name of it, I might not have called my product Stroll Runner. And the second one is Kid Runner. So I actually inadvertently married these two things into my own product, the two names. But Stroll Smart is, I actually ordered one for myself, and I'm fairly certain there's a limited supply left over. But they had something that is basically a square, and you attach it to your body. They did a great job with the belt that they created that goes around the person. And then it goes forward and connects onto the stroller. But they were missing two things. And in reading the reviews, it was very obvious. They didn't have a comfort level. Three things. The comfort level was not there in terms of user comfort when they're wearing it.
Right.
It's very cumbersome to attach onto the stroller. And one of my main missions with this was making it easy. If it's not easy, you're not going to do it. You'll just run with your stroller the way it is.
Right.
And then they didn't have the steerability. Kid Runner, I believe that that was created out of finding the difficulty in pushing the stroller in front of you and still having that ability to steer. So they created an entire system that you pull behind you. It doesn't work with the stroller that you would already own. You have to purchase the whole system. It's somewhere in the $850 to $950 range, last I looked, in terms of price. And it's a belt that goes around you, and then you pull the whole thing behind you, it's a fantastic solution to the problem. However, you can't see your child when you're running.
Right.
And I have this thought, like, I know now, having my youngest, that, you know, if she doesn't see me, she's, you know, screaming. And so you can't, having mommy run away from her in front would probably be somewhat scary for her psychologically. So she's used to being in the stroller and being pushed forward. The price point makes it hard for accessibility. And, you know, if you already have a stroller that you're spending $650 on, which is pretty much the average of a good jogging stroller these days, but then you need to purchase this other product as well, that's hindering. And so I wanted something that was going to be in a price point that was accessible to as many people as possible. We even have payment plans on the website now that I just launched a new website last week. So we just want to get it in as many people's hands as possible.
Heather, I knew some point this morning I would confuse you with the great actress Helen Hayes, and I apologize.
No offense taken.
Heather, did you have like a group of parents who would try each new design to see how it was working? You said, I think you had 16 different iterations of Stroll Runner before you came up with, this is it, this is what we're going to go with.
I did, not for each iteration, but we did have three different groups of beta testers. And recently we've been interviewing some people, getting out in the community, letting people try it, getting some good video. But yes, we had three different groups, and each time it was very eye-opening to see and humbling to see what it was that they would like for changes to the design or just their different experiences that they had. And it's always great to get this other information. I mean, I've used it, you know, for 4+ years now, so I'm very familiar with it. But having other people try it was definitely a necessity. We had people here in Vermont. I had people across the country. Our weather isn't always conducive to running,
right,
especially winter months. So it was great to have people, you know, California, Florida.
And
great feedback.
You know, when you started this, what was your end goal? Was this something you were just hoping to make for you and a close group of friends or a running club? Or did you have a business in mind?
You know, that's a great question. I think initially it was to get the idea out of my head and not to go through life wondering what if, or to watch somebody else create this. I think we've all had a multitude of ideas, like, wouldn't it be great if this existed? And then we find it and we're like, oh, somebody else already came up with that. I didn't want that to be how I looked back at this, knowing that I could have created something and someone else had the ambition to go out and do it instead. So initially it was just, let me reach that goal for myself. I fell in love with the business side of it once I got going. I mean, I was a sponge. My day job is as a mortgage loan officer, and I've done that for 20 years now. I've been saying 20 years for probably the last 5 years, but I think really I have hit 20 years now. And I took a break from the mortgage business in 2019. I retired, quote unquote, and took a full year to just work on Stroll Runner. And Vermont is so rich with entrepreneurial ecosystem and education, and I mean, everybody wants to help everybody else, and I really hope I can give back in that respect too. So I welcome anybody, you know, I'll just put this out there, anybody who's thinking about starting a business, you know, please feel free to reach out to me personally. I love talking about the journey, if you will, that I've been on. But I just spent that year attending classes at the Center for Women in Enterprise. I actually did a little stint working there for a little while, hoping to mentor people. I networked, like I said earlier. I met with anybody I could. I went to all the events I could. I worked out of Vermont Center for Emerging Technologies, VSET, in Burlington. I just immersed myself, and the culture is amazing, and I absolutely fell in love with it. So the business side has been exciting for me, and I think I really enjoy that. And that's probably something that I will go back into full time at some point once I get the business a little bit more profitable and off the ground. But the last, I launched in August on my first daughter's birthday, which was intentional. And it's been a little bit slow since then, only because I, you know, surprisingly found out I was pregnant last May and went for round two. So the pregnancy, you know, adding all of that in and having time out on maternity leave definitely put this a little bit on the back burner, but we're back in action now. And I would love to see this move forward, and I would love to just continue running the business.
Yeah, no pun intended again. The runner's parents are one part of the equation. How did you know this apparatus wasn't making running or strolling a pain for the kids in the actual strollers?
In terms of utilizing this product?
Yes. You just assume that if they are okay with a jogger stroller, they're okay with this as well?
Yeah, so this doesn't really affect the child at all. They wouldn't know any different, except that, you know, it might take a second for mom or dad to stop and put a brake on. And we, like I said earlier, we tried to make it as easy as possible. So in and out of this, you know, very quickly, there's just a side clip on the belt. So you just clip, and you can just let it go, and it'll hang right on the stroller handle. I don't think that the child would know the difference, honestly.
Okay. Now,
they're just along for the ride.
Yeah. Body style, Heather. You know, they come in basically 7.7 billion different forms. So how does the stroll runner work for different people?
So we tried to make this as much of a one-size-fits-all as possible. Mm-hmm. One of the earlier designs we were super excited about had the arm coming towards the person's body. It rested down lower on your abdomen, kind of a hip region. And then there was a belt that came up around your waist, and it just seemed like this perfect design. It was down low. You had all the stability. This is prior to the wheel damper edition. I was so excited about it, and then I had my engineer's wife try it on, and it didn't fit her at all. It fit me perfectly, but it did not fit her. And so that we had to scrap the entire idea and go back to the drawing board. So this is just make it as simple and comfortable as possible for each person. The belly plate has just a little bit of a curve to it. I'll tell you a secret. I curve those belly plates on a lobster pot by hand. So the belly plates come to me flat. And I looked around my house one day and I thought, well, I'm putting all these together. How am I going to make this round? And I saw a lobster pot in my basement and I grabbed that and just rolled it around on there and it perfectly curved it.
Wow.
So if it's a little off, it's probably a kink in my pot. but it should hopefully fit comfortably on any person. And then, you know, you can just, the belt is very simple. It's basically seat belt material. It has a reflective, we special ordered this so that it has reflective webbing through it that's sewn in. And then you just put whatever size you want, and then you coil up whatever excess there is, if there's excess, and then it just simply sits on your side.
Now, the other thing is there are also a number of jogging strollers. Does Stroll Runner work with all of them?
I would like to say yes, but I cannot say that. It depends on two factors, the stroller handle. So we designed this right now. It fits on most best. It fits on Bob and Thule strollers, which are the two most popular. There's a lot of other very popular strollers, but they aren't true jogging strollers. Mm. So this, if you're actually a runner, you would probably own one of the two of those. And it's meant to fit on a straight bar handle. And there's a lot of handles out there that are curved, kind of a U shape. In the future, that will be hopefully a fit kit that we can offer, so you wouldn't have to buy a whole separate stroll runner. We want to keep it as simple as possible again. So there will probably be a fit kit that would allow this to go onto a curved handlebar. The second piece is it's got to be a three wheel. And right now, the damper fits on those two models is what we tried it for or what we built it for. However, it would be very simple to modify that design to be able to fit on other strollers in the future. It's really about what's coming out. So we need to stay on top of the market. Bob and Thule, you're trying to continuously come out with better and better jogging strollers, and they do a great job with the strollers. So we need to stay on top of what their design is so that we can modify where needed.
Mm. Now, how long does it take to set this up to your stroller and ultimately your waist?
So I would say probably first time, maybe 5 to 10 minutes. The wheel damper is just, it's one and done. So once you put it on there, you don't have to take it off, even if you're not jogging or even if you don't want to use it. It can just stay right on there. You can unclip the bungees. We have a great tutorial video that we put together that's on the website.
Yep.
There's also printable instructions, but it's very simple to do that. And then when you're putting the piece onto the handlebar, it's just a lock and clip system. So it's a piece of material that goes up and around the stroller handle, clips in, you tighten it. And then as far as, I would say the longest it takes is on the 10-minute side is because this is fully adjustable to the person who's using it. So you want to figure out what's going to be comfortable for you. Once you put it around your waist and clip, you want to find, do you want this to fit you tightly? Do you want it loose? I prefer tight. And so I cinch that thing as hard as I can and coil it up. And then also the distance from the runner to the stroller is adjustable. So we have, loosen up the two arm plates fit together and slide out and in. So you can adjust your distance to the stroller. Mainly that's for the ability to reach the brake on the stroller. We want safety first. We want everyone to be able to reach that foot brake. Some strollers have a handbrake too on the stroller handle, which is great, but you can adjust that distance. So once you find what's comfortable for you, it's pretty much just set. And you can take it right off of the handle. You can flip it up over the stroller. You can let it hang down. It's very simple.
I watched the video, and I'm pretty sure even I could make this work. Heather Hayes is the inventor. I need it. Inventor and CEO of Stroll Runner. And to learn more, you can visit strollrunner.com. Heather, thank you so much for being on this morning and for making things just a little bit easier on parents.
Happy to be able to. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Sure thing. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then we'll return to open up the phones until 10. Sox are off tonight. That means we got Brady Farkas Show at 5:30, Jazz with George Thomas at 7, and Eye on the World from 9 to 1 with John Batchelor. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Hey, Danny, open up those phones. The numbers are 802, I'm going to give my cell number. That's a bad thing. Oh, man. How long have I been doing this show? 802-244-1777. Danny's walking off the job. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay, as always with open phones, you can go off the board, talk about what you want. That usually results in a homework assignment. And I still have a couple from last week on long-term health care and advanced directives. Also, I drove up to Island Pond on Friday in preparation for my next stop on the WDEV 90th anniversary tour. I think this is stop 10 or 11. Some of the places on the way up, Trencher's Farmhouse in Lindenville, Northeast Kingdom Country Store and Sanderson's Wooden Bowls in East Burke, Dirt Church Brewing in East Haven, and then in Island Pond, Cucina de Gerardo, where I had the best calzone of my life on Friday. I'm telling you, I'll talk about that. But if there are other places in the kingdom that you want to recommend to people, let us know. 802-244-1777. I'm learning the phone numbers all over again. And 877-291-8255. Was I off for like a week or two? What's going on? How about this? Sox seem to have turned the corner. A sweep this weekend, 5 straight wins, 8 of 10. What's your assessment of the team so far this season? Phones are open. You can call us, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's more like it. Or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let's start with the Duke of Newbury, Fred. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning.
Your grace.
Okay. And so anyways, I stumbled upon a very interesting article on the internet. And it really, it was, I mean, you'll have to read it. It's just so good. But anyways, the name of the article is The Rubicon Theory of War. Now, you know what the Rubicon's all about, right?
Teach me.
The Rubicon is when, let's see, what was his name? Caesar crossed the Rubicon. War was inevitable, and there was no turning back. So if you cross the Rubicon, there's no turning back.
Interesting.
The whole deal about crossing the Rubicon, right?
Right.
Okay, so now what happened in World War II is Hitler crossed the Rubicon when he attacked Poland. And that brought the British and the French into the war. Okay?
Right.
So then the other one is when Fort Sumter was attacked by the South, that caused the Civil War.
Sure.
So what happens, now the whole thing behind this is leadership. So here's what the deal is. The leadership thinks that they can win when they do this, right? And so they have this theory that they can win, but they really don't realize that when you cross this Rubicon, there's no turning back. And so what happened? The Nazis lost World War II. The South lost the Civil War. And so right now, if you go to Ukraine, it doesn't look good for the Russians either.
Right.
So anyways, it's very interesting. You ought to read it.
I love it. That is interesting, Fred. And I was not not a military history expert, and I had never – I don't know the Rubicon theory until you brought it up, and I think it's very interesting. You know, where is that point? You know, now no one's rushing in to help Ukraine, and they've got to fight on their own pretty much with, except with military aid, or financial aid. It's a little different if the Rubicon becomes Finland, for instance, as they are joining NATO. But yeah, this point, this idea that there is, a Rubicon, a river to cross that, you know, starts the war, and then you're in. You are committed to the very end to see it through.
That's why we have NATO.
Yeah.
That's why we have NATO.
Yeah, yep. You're absolutely correct.
And guess what?
Go ahead.
Ukraine wasn't a part of NATO.
No, it wasn't. It was leaning towards applying. And, yeah, it might have been a...
So they have it. And then why does Sweden and Finland want to join NATO?
Yeah, you know why.
Yes, you know why.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Fred?
And so when you look at it, and just look at human history. Human history has been a part of war forever.
Yeah.
We've always had war.
Sadly.
We know we're going to have one. There's no escape from war.
Yeah. Fred, I can't believe it, but for the second call in a row, I'm going to say you are making excellent points. Thanks, Fred. All right, let's move on to Forbes in Corinth. Hey, Forbes.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Great.
I want to just personally object to Biden's latest comments sword rattling with Taiwan.
Mm.
We've got diplomats to communicate these internal workings, and I think to bring it out in the manner in which he did is totally irresponsible. We're looking at people trying to invest in this country right now. All we need is more worry and whatnot to really create a nightmare for us. I don't think his comments were appropriate at all, and I think the whole world reacted to it.
You know, Forbes, my first thought was, like you, a cringe, and we know Joe Biden has one particular fault, and that is that kind of shoot from the hip, you know, make these comments on occasion, you know, just that are unscripted. And that's what I felt this was. And as, again, the most powerful person in the free world, the President of the United States, you can't do that. And I'm not sure what comes of it. Does it, you know, does it make China pull back a little, think twice? Maybe. But like you're saying, the saber rattling, you know, do you want to take that chance? There are probably better ways to craft that answer, more diplomatic ways to address it, ways that, you know, your staff and your speech writers have developed for you, right, to answer this question. It's not like it's a question when you're visiting Southeast Asia that's not going to come up. You know it's going to come up, right, Forbes? You're going to be asked this. So you have correct. An answer yeah. ready. And is that the answer that they crafted, that he
You know, China is not the JV team.
No, they're not.
As one, but on the other hand, we need a little bit of stability in this country right now. We don't need people scared to death. You know, we're fighting some tough odds right now.
Yeah, and I mean, let's be honest. You know, presidents before have said things and then walked them back a little, and I guess. That it'll be interesting to hear in the aftermath of that comment what President Biden will do and will say. But I like you, got shivers because we've been around long enough to know that, you know, sometimes you can poke the bear and it wakes him up. And we do not want that. We do not want to be fighting on that front. Either. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Forbes, but, yeah.
Those are my feelings. I think there are many others.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think many others, too, absolutely felt the same way. Not the best way to draw that line with China. There's probably far better ways. As Forbes said, this is why we have diplomats and diplomacy and deliver messages. Not in public, and what to me seems like kind of a Joe Biden faux pas, too, you know, just one of those shoot from the hip Joe-isms. All right. I've wedged the phones open for your enjoyment and thoughts. If you'd like to join the discussion or create it, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255 on this Victoria Day, Canadian Victoria Day today. We'll talk about that after the break. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. We've got open phones until 10, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. We're discussing places in the kingdom that you're particularly fond of. Oh, and speaking of places in the kingdom, the Hinterland Market in South Albany, reopening by June 1st, I understand. Oh, I can't wait. They make amazing Jamaican hand pies, soft pretzels, sauerkraut. Can't wait till they open again. You can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Happy Victoria's Day. Victoria Day in Canada. That means so it's like the Monday before Queen Victoria's birthday is when they celebrate it. And like our Memorial Day, it's kind of the unofficial start of summer in Canada. So congratulations and happy Victoria Day to our friends north of the border. Let's head north to Eden. Talk to Brian. Good morning, Brian.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah, Fred and Forbes called. I guess I feel I have to.
right.
And I'll keep politics to a minimum, but, you know, Joe Biden will say whatever he says. But it's been a longstanding policy to defend Taiwan. I don't think we ever backed off of defending Taiwan. It's just to say it out loud, and, you know, I agree with the diplomacy. But to happier things, it's a wonderful spring. Like, that dry spell with all that rain, has an amazing effect on the perennials. Like they push their roots down really deeply because of the dry. And then when the rain comes, they just go crazy. It's such great weather.
Yeah.
And up in the kingdom, my favorite place is Brunswick Springs.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very difficult to find.
Right.
The Abnaki own it now, but I used to go up there before they even owned it. And that is quite a place. If you've never been up there, it's worth the hike here, and it's not very far. It's like a mile. And there used to be a series, I think, two or three hotels there. And they burned in the 1880s, 1890s, around the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. And they always called it the Abnaki curse, although I think it's just the curse of being too far from the fire department.
That'll do it.
The hotel. But anyway, it's still kind of almost the edge of winter up there, even with all this heat. They're just getting into spring. So.
Well, what's funny is the one thing I did see a little patch of snow up on Burke Mountain as I was driving back. But it was beautiful to see the colors of green. You know, Brian, you've got the deep greens from the pines, but also at this time, you know, it is kind of spring-ish in Vermont. And so you have that almost neon green of the fresh grass and the fresh buds on trees. So you have these beautiful contrasts of green colors going on right now as you're driving around the kingdom. It's almost as beautiful as fall in the kingdom, right? You know, as being up there in autumn.
No, but Willoughby stays really cold all the way to the end of July.
That is a glacial lake, and it does stay cold indeed.
All right.
All right, great recommendation on Brunswick Springs.
Yeah, get people out there to enjoy it. It's except for the mayflies, and they'll be gone.
Oh, right. Yeah. Thanks,
Brian.
Right.
Take care.
All right, I do want to mention that I will have as a guest a representative of the Silvio Conti National Refuge, Fish and Wildlife Refuge, on the show, talk about that area. And got an email from Matt, who's recommended, this is a great recommendation, Frank Allard, who worked on the railroad and has many great stories. I have booked Frank to be on the show. Frank's in his 90s, still going strong. And as soon as I called him, he was, oh, yeah, I'll be on the show. So we'll get some great background on the history, that railroad history of Island Pond, from someone who worked, I think, 37 years on the railroad from like the 50s to the late 80s. So Frank will be on the show. Gordon Lefevre and his wife Rebecca, also amazing couple. I have reached out to them, but haven't heard back to them. And I think I might be full of guests, but I have one more slot I'm waiting to hear about. But it's always good to have more rather than less people to reach out to. Matt, thanks for that great email. Two people, believe it or not, that I have reached out to, and one that I definitely will have. All right, what else are we talking about? Oh, I want to talk about this calzone. You know I love to talk food. So this, you know, I had to drive all the way up there. I hadn't had lunch. I think all I had was a half of yogurt all day long. And finally, around 2 o'clock, it was time to eat. And I'd heard great things about this little place called Cucina di Gerardo. And I'm now calling the owner Santo Gerardo because he is a saint when it comes to making food. It's like a holy moment with his food. Almost everything that he uses, the ingredients, come directly from Italy. He's originally from Napoli. He spent time, had a restaurant in the north end of Boston, which you know is a fabulous place to go to dinner. And then eventually had places in the Upper Valley, a few different restaurants, retired up to like West Charleston, up in the kingdom, and decided, you know, oh, what the heck, I'm here. I might as well open one more Italian restaurant. And I walked in, nobody in on a Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. So it's just me and Santo Gerardo. And give me a calzone. It was the single best calzone I've ever had in my life. If he had just served me the dough and the sauce, I would have been in heaven. But I had it filled with pepperoni, sausage, green and black olives, and it was phenomenal. So that's just another place in the kingdom. When you get up to the kingdom, you are reaching back in time to that Vermont that, you know, it's not always we don't always find it everywhere around us. And Island Pond is one of those towns. It feels like you're driving back into the, you know, 1960s or 70s. Lovely people, the beautiful big pond there with the island out in the middle, the walkway, the kind of wooden bridge that takes you up over the railroad tracks. And one thing we'll learn next this week, this Thursday, is how many railroad tracks there are now compared to when it was at its heyday. All right, we did have one other caller who wanted to know, why did I move from Miami to Vermont? The move I call the single best move of my entire life. And the other thing I say is it gets better for me here every single day. So I had a job at an ad agency in Miami, which I brought with me, a writing gig, and also the prospect of doing a little radio at The Point in Montpelier. And I was here a week when the morning guy quit, and I was offered the morning job. And so I did the mornings at The Point and wrote in the afternoon for the ad agency in Miami. And it has been over 19 years, and I have loved every single day being in this wonderful place. That's the truth. All right, Danny, that should do it for the open phones this morning. We're going to break for CBS News. Then we'll return to meet one of the WDEV All-Stars that many people turn to every single day. And coming up this morning at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre, followed by the Midday News Service with Lee Cattell and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm not making this up. In yesterday's Sunday Boston Globe crossword puzzle, the clue for 34 across was Roger on the radio. Are you kidding me? The fame of WDEV forecaster Roger Hill has reached to Beantown? But the answer had five letters. Okay, maybe they still aren't quite where we are, recognizing the importance of having Roger Hill on the air to tell us what's in the air each day. The crossword answer, so they say, was Wilco. But that doesn't change that Roger Hill is a WDEV All-Star, and he is with us this morning. Roger, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, it's great to be back, Rick.
You thought the answer was Hill, too, didn't you? Roger on the radio.
I was trying to go through Ramjet. Let's see, Dodger.
Oh, Ramjet.
Because people named Roger, you get called different things.
Yep. Listeners, if you've got a question.
Good and sometimes they're bad.
We only say good things about you.
Yes.
If you've got a question for Roger about his career in meteorology, you can call us 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I think you're a Cali guy. Where did you grow up?
Cali.
Yep.
I'm born and raised in Southern California, and then I kind of went all over the country in various places, Hawaii to New York to North Carolina, Eastern North Carolina and Outer Banks and all that.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, growing up in California, what was it like, you know, living where year-round there was just nice weather?
Awful.
It says the weather guy.
I kind of started out, you know, I was really into weather when I was in high school. And so I'd be one of these geek guys that didn't have a lot of friends. And I was, you know, a little nerdy and this sort of thing. And I was either I had three choices. What was really interesting to me was aviation, so I was really into air traffic control.
Mm.
Thanks to Palm Springs, that was my high school, and they're a little bit of a – they had a pretty good budget at that point back in California. Schools are really quite good. And they had an aviation science program, and the end of the – for 2 years was you had to take the ground school, pass the test to complete the class to fly a plane. And I thought that was for me. So
yeah.
I learned aviation. I was into weather already, so I got aviation meteorology kind of background. And I'm in high school, you know. But then there was a lot of things that, you know, happened to be Palm Springs. This guy named Crick, he happened to be the forecaster for D-Day, and he ran an operation out of Palm Springs. And I used to go there when I was a high schooler and pull the aviation weather observations off the teletypes and this, and he'd let me have it, and I'd study it, and you know, things kind of developed from there. So that
what a great start. Now, I believe also – you know, one of your favorite things is music. I think you're a pretty darn good drummer. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been doing drums for about, I don't know, 50 years now or something. 13, yeah, 60, man, I don't know.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Were you ever in any bands of any note? Or
I've been in like about 50 bands, maybe, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, several BTUs in Vermont. I was in a band called Sandy in the High Country in California, and we went. It was in Owens Valley, so it was kind of a, you know, smaller scale kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the top of the line for me was we got to open for Emmylou Harris. It was a kind of a country rock band, and so I remember Emmylou Harris sitting in on my drum throne, and that was like, oh yeah, that's pretty cool.
Oh my gosh, that's when I would retire. That'd be enough. I've reached the pinnacle.
Yeah, but drumming my money makers have been drumming and meteorology.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about meteorology. Where did you learn all about? I mean, granted, you started out, you know, helping in that place, but where did you learn all about diamond dust and bombogenesis and all the other cool stuff that, you know, we need to know about when you bring us the forecast every day?
Well, I think experience is underrated. It's something that you can't, you know, you learn a lot of stuff. You teach, you know, college education and hierarchy or whatever, not academics. I kind of went off in a different route. I kind of learned sort of around that, almost mm-hmm. like, you know, it caused me to actually learn more, but I wouldn't recommend it for anybody who wants to be a meteorologist. I would recommend going to a 4-year school like Northern Vermont University,
yep.
A great meteorology program, excellent. A lot of the folks you see in the Weather Channel are from there.
Yeah, the Linden.
Linden and Penn State and, you know, yep. Pretty highly rated. But there's so many of them out there. A lot of them focus on research, and that was more I was really interested. So, but I was terrible in math and never got my, you know, passed into differential calculus. So I never got a full degree in meteorology, but I had a ton of experience. But I learned a lot of my weather start was in the Army, the U.S. Army. So.
Oh.
It was during the end of the Vietnam War. It was still a little bit hairy, but we were going out of, you know, voluntary service. Into voluntary service at that point. So,
right.
So I elected to become a ballistic meteorological crewman, which you have to send up weather balloons for the trajectories of artillery and whatnot. And so ballistic meteorological crewman. You send up a lot of weather balloons, and this is before the day of computers, and so I had to do everything by hand. We had to do all this stuff by hand, and boy, you're forced in the military.
Yeah.
On the job, you get to play with Uncle Sam's toys, but you're forced right into it. And at 18 years old, it took off, and I had my 3-year tour, and then I got out. But I was based in Hawaii, and I learned how to surf. And I'm a pretty good surfer. I used to be a long time ago, but. Yeah, I got to surf the North Shore and this, you know. So there was a lot of cool things about the aspects of being in the Army. But I hated it, of course, when I was in the Army.
Sure.
And you want to get out. And I wasn't a lifer. I wasn't a, you know, 20-year man or anything.
Right.
But it taught me so much. The military, if you go into a meteorological an MOS would be a military occupational skill. If you go into your skill and it does stuff on the outside – folks who want to, you know, go in the military, I would highly recommend it, knowing that, well, you might be called into a war because you never know what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's always that. Let's take a call. We got Fred joining us from Newberry. Go ahead, Fred.
Oh, this is the question I've always had. I can't just figure it out. You're the guy to talk to. Here's the question. Weather is also known as meteorology. Can you tell me what meteorology has to do with weather?
Fred, good question.
That's a great question. I know, and you'd think that somebody in astronomy, you know, would have more, you know, it would be some kind of crossover. But we don't learn much about meteorites. We know about the atmosphere that rock or whatever it is that falls into it. And so I think that's the connection. But truthfully, I really don't know how far back and why that is. One of our first bona fide meteorologists in the country was Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, right.
And he was considered, and he learned, for example, things like what a nor'easter is. And he actually coined the word nor'easter.
Interesting.
A lot of people don't know that because he saw from Philadelphia, he was, you know, raised in Massachusetts and Boston, and his travels, he was very, one of these observant kind of guys that was very observant to the natural surroundings and pondered so many things we know about his history. The fact that a storm occurred in Philadelphia on one day produced a lot of snow, and then he traveled back to Boston, and that same storm had just produced snow in Boston. So he figured out, these big storms go somewhere up the coast and toward the northeast. So he called it a nor'easter because they also have northeast winds when they occur based on the track. Mm. So, yeah.
And another person who really dedicated their life to meteorology, we know him for photographing snowflakes, but Snowflake Bentley did a lot of work in photographing fronts and clouds and understanding meteorology. And he's from right here in Jericho,
amazing
village of Nashville. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Northeast U.S., I mean, especially northern New England, has so much change in weather. Weather forecasting out here is much harder than it is pretty much anywhere in the country.
Really?
Although there's always these niches that, I mean, well, take L.A. You can play with the fog and low cloud marine layer so much, right? But you can get pretty good at it if it's going to hit Civic Center versus Santa Monica. So, and the temperature, of course, it drives the temperature if it's hot inland and so forth. So, even Southern California has a million niches. So meteorology is a very wide open kind of aspects. There's so many niches going on.
Or maybe I'm counting down to number one, so you're near the top. That's possible. Hey, let's take another call. We've got Brian joining us from Eden. Hi, Brian.
Hey, riding on Fred's coattails again or whatever. Again.
Gotcha.
That's okay. I hope the mayflies are treating you well down there, Roger. And
they treat me great.
Right. Meteorology, it's like the etymology is Greek, and it means eruption in the atmosphere.
That works.
So, the rocks coming down, comets, anything, the weather, they didn't have our scientific knowledge of the layers of the atmosphere and stuff. So, that's where it comes from. It means eruption in the atmosphere, which would include weather and shooting stars.
Perfect.
Brilliant. Thanks, Brian, for clearing that up. All right. Now, Roger, let's get back to some of the music. You said you've played, you know, in 50 different bands. Was it always country rock? Do you play a bunch of different genres?
A little bit of quite a considerable amount of funk, kind of funky type beats and this kind of thing. But I kind of learned off, you know, the classic rock and, you know, Ginger, you know, Cream and Jimi Hendrix and the time of the sort of late 60s. And my sister actually... She won't like me saying this on the air, but I'm going to do it. She lives in California, so she's Arizona. She's not going to hear me. She dated Mick Jagger for a time.
Get out.
She got to know, actually, the drummer's name, which I'm blanking on.
Charlie Watts.
And Charlie Watts, she talked me into learn how to drum. And she would play Rolling Stone records, and this is in the mid-60s, and she's about 10 years older than me, so she was, you know, so her influence caused me to learn how to play drums, and then I got a snare drum, and then eventually a full set.
Anybody else you have connections with in rock and roll that I like that connection to Mick Jagger. You're just like
I'm just trying to think who, as far as opening for, you ever heard of April Wine?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did a wedding up
Canadian
in
band.
Yeah,
Canadian band. I have a bunch of their albums, and I actually got to see them open up before a Toronto Argonauts football game.
Yeah, we got to. I got to play drums. Well, we crossed over a little bit there. There was a wedding. One of the band members, the lead singer, was getting the guitarist was getting married. This is back a couple decades ago. But anyway.
And you played with April Ryan.
Played a little bit with April Ryan. We were kind of playing for April Ryan.
And yeah.
So that was kind of like, wow, April Ryan wants us to play, really? And that was at the time that Bonnie Raitt was really in that kind of style of, you know, blues rock, you might say.
Yeah. That's my gosh. Default. All right, I'm impressed, Roger. Now, drummers in bands, I don't know how to put this delicately. They're the ones who you show up at to see a band, and all of a sudden it's like, well, who's that guy? Oh, that's our drummer for tonight. The drummers seem to be kind of fluid. You know, what's up with that?
Well, it's those damn guitarists, you know. They think they – no, there's really not a rival. We have to play together, but certainly the vocalists and the guitarists will get – first, you know, the drummer's just sitting behind the cymbals, you know, kind of doing their thing. But, boy, when the drummer stops, the band is screwed.
That's right.
And so we really control the whole deal.
There you go.
They don't know that.
So stop picking on those drummers, you guitarists. All right.
Except in jazz. Now, jazz, the drummer takes precedent. And I'm kind of getting in a little bit more into jazz.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. And how about what you listen to? Do you have favorite bands or styles or genres?
Pretty wide open.
Yeah.
Really wide open. I mean, I like classic music under certain situations, or folk or something. Mm-hmm. It has no rhythm at all. But I'm more rhythmically oriented, so I'm attracted to probably now funk, jazz, rock, blues rock. That's kind of where I'm at. But
nice. The
blues part is more like, you know, it's knowing when not to hit and when not to play, and the dynamics of that.
Yeah.
Most drummers, you know, start out just, you know, bashing. And it takes them quite a while. And also, a lot of drummers just stick in that sort of rock mode.
Right.
They should deviate into other realms, and they will learn a lot of stuff, you know, that'll cause them to play a lot better.
Yeah.
And but drummers have a tendency to learn their dynamics quite a ways later on. And, of course, they upset a lot of guitarists because of that and vocalists. So, it's a loud instrument.
It's a learning curve, guys. Yeah. Leave the drummers alone. What brought you up to Vermont? So you started – you were in the Army. You were in Hawaii doing meteorology, and then a few other stops along the way. And then what got you here?
Considerable. So just to kind of run through them real quick. So after the Army, I got into the National Weather Service as a forecaster aide. I think they called it a communicator. And your job was basically just pulling teletype stuff and giving stuff to certain people and using it as a reference or whatever. And no forecasting and very little observing or any of that stuff. Then eventually I got into the observing, and then eventually data acquisition. I had upper air experience with the Army, so I was way ahead of the game. Mm. Eventually I got into forecasting. A lot of the forecasters showed a lot of interest in that. So pretty soon I was forecasting for them when they were, you know, sleeping in a midnight shift. I shouldn't say that. But, writing TAFs and the aviation terminal forecasts and this kind of thing for aviation. So they had to double check it. And, of course, you know, you learn a lot of stuff. And so I worked at the L.A. forecast office. And then from there, I went to Great Falls, Montana, upper air. From there, I went to Ely, Nevada. It was probably my worst place, although I had my encounters with a UFO at one point there.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting thing there happened. But then, let's see, I went to Bishop, California, was pilot briefer, and then I was in a really good band, Sandy and the High Country, out west, and we won the Battle of the Bands. We had movie stars come and play with us a couple times.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. You know, Bakersfield on the other side of the Sierra, well, we were on the desert side, the Owens Valley, and the guy in Hee Haw, I forget his
name. Roy Clark? Owens.
Owens. He played with us.
Chad Owens, was it?
Yes. Chad Owens. Yes. I believe that was his name. But, you know, weird things like that. Again, I'm just the drummer. You know, so I'm just a little bit lower key in this kind of thing. But so from Bishop, I had to go to Cape Hatteras because they had to actually cut the station at the time. And then they reopened it later after I was there. But we would do a lot of pilot briefing there, about 60 a day, which is really high.
Yeah.
And so we got really good. If you worked at Bishop as a pilot briefer, you were really good. And then I went to Cape Hatteras, and, of course, I learned Weather Service Radar 57, the old WSR 57s that were 1957 is when it came out. So I was born in 55, right? So this radar has been, and they were, you know. So after that, I went to Albany. I did that for about 2 years, and I got really good in hurricanes and weather radar and severe weather, which they have a considerable amount of it out in North Carolina. Yep. Then I went to Albany. I became the radar focal point as a med tech, and got to work there. And again, I was doing some forecasting, and then I met my lovely wife in Schenectady. She was working in Schenectady at General Electric, and she was from Montpelier. So I wanted to always come to Vermont and tried to bid on a few Burlington jobs. There were never any openings, and they were considered to be a very hard place to get to because nobody wanted to leave. And it's true. It's that kind of that way today, I think, a little bit. Eventually I went from Albany and got out of the Weather Service after spending about 12 years in the Weather Service. And then, I went to Marshfield, lived in Marshfield for quite a while, started up my own business called Weather or Not. And then then I went back into the Weather Service. I lost my Weather or Not affiliation because somebody else got it in the Midwest, some other company. And I said, okay, yeah, I'm back in the Weather Service. And then I decided I really don't like the shift work and I want to go back and do my own thing. And that was about 1998. And then I had talked to Eric Michaels. I had taken observations at the Montpelier Airport and worked with a neat crew there, and it was a blast. Except that job shut down, so it forced me to move into other realms. And I said, okay, I'm starting my own company, Weathering Heights.
Great
name. Moved to Worcester. It's a Weathering Heights. It's Weathered Heights. It's exactly what it's called.
Yeah.
It's kind of a little stupid takeoff of Wuthering Heights.
Mm-hmm.
But it is what it is, and I've got a lot of utility contracts because I'm pretty good in radar because of what I learned in the Weather Service. So experience, even though you may not get the credit, experience is very underrated.
Yeah. How long have you been with Radio Vermont Group?
1998.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was like a couple years when I wasn't, and maybe about a year, I think, maybe. And then I came back, and I had talked to Eric Michaels and decided, yeah, okay, I'm their weather guy, and I'll prove what I can do, and that's where things are.
Over two decades. Nothing makes me happier. I don't know how you feel when I'm listening, and it might be, Wild Bill calls in or a sponsor like Mark McCarthy or Eric Bashaw will cite one of your weather forecasts. Well, Roger told me this morning, you know, and it's this great kind of.
I feel very weird about this.
Do you really?
I
think it's a neat camaraderie. Crawls. Oh, no, I think, you know,
I'm not against them doing that. It's just that I know how flawed a human being I am and how opinionated I am. And I can be a big jerk. And so
well, we're all big jerks.
And walk on water stuff is scary.
No, it's just neat that they people cite you, you know, and say, well, we know Roger told us we're going to have this. Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill, definitely a WDEV All-Star. Roger, thanks for joining me this morning. Next on the list of All-Stars will be getaway host Greg Hooker, who will be on this Friday. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break for CBS News Update and then return to hear the poetry of Laura Badofsky-Wisniewski. And coming up today at 1, we've got Travels with Charlie Papillo. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We are back on Vermont Viewpoint. In the past few weeks, we've chatted with the folks from the Poetry Society of Vermont and with noted slam poet Jeff Hewitt. Now we're going to meet a Hinesburg poet whose new collection has been drawing notice from some pretty impressive places. Of Laura Badowski Wisniewski's Sanctuary Vermont, the New York Times wrote, quote, evoking a century plus of the doings in one rural Vermont town where every day has at least one marvelous thing. Wisniewski's debut builds to a novelistic sense of place and plenitude with shades of Thornton Wilder or Edgar Lee Masters. Laura Badowski Wisniewski joins us now to discuss and read from Sanctuary Vermont. Laura, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, great having you. Listeners, to ask Laura about her poetry, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Laura, when did you start writing poetry?
Oh, I guess I started as a child and really continued doing it on and off just for myself for a very long time. But I guess it's when I turned 60 that I decided to really commit more attention to it and to think about getting publishing. But I think maybe when I was 10, it was my first poem.
What drew you to poetry in the first place? And then at 60, what was that bell that went off that said, I'm 50 years in, I'm going to get serious about this thing?
When I was a kid, my mother read me Edgar Allan Poe. And I remember thinking, just, I like that. Don't get it, but love it. And there were just some books of poetry around, and it just appealed to me. I think, different things sort of call to different people, and that called to me. And then when I started writing it, it was really a place, first of all, to express my feelings. And when I write poetry, I get to go someplace that I don't get to go any other way. And, when I turned 60, I'm not the only one who had one of those if not now, then when moments.
Yeah.
And I just decided, why not? And it meant so much to me. My kids are grown. I actually had the breathing room to, put the time into it. And, I went to Vermont Studio Center a couple of times, which was really helpful to see other people who actually were taking their work seriously. Mm-hmm. And, I think that's another thing that isn't that uncommon for people at a certain point to go, now or never.
That's right. Well, what will readers find in your latest collection, Sanctuary Vermont?
Of course, I'm much better at writing the poems than talking about them.
Of course, yes.
It's a kind of poetic biography, I would say, of an imaginary small Vermont town. And it moves through history from 1816, well, not counting one poem set in 450 million BCE, but from 1816 into the present, and then very briefly takes a peek into the future. And the poems speak in voices of many different characters from a wide variety of backgrounds and experiences. I think partly those poems explore both deep social fault lines of the town and enduring compassion and resilience of its inhabitants.
Now, the book is divided into two sections, then and now. I'm going to ask you to read several of selections, but my first choice is from the then section. I believe it relates to the cover photo of the collection. The poem is The Great Flood, 1927.
Oh, okay. And I just have to say, I found that photo from Vermont Historical Society, so this is a great resource.
Mm.
I'll read this poem.
All right.
The Great Flood, 1927. Here at the bend, Pond Brook has overrun its banks.
a man in a thin black tie and high black boots slogs from shack to shack, warning us to seek high ground. And you, with your fine wife, your clean sons, your house of high calm from which you can look down from Buckthorn Hill, you see us, the swamp of our town, the roads tracked out like tears to the farmlands, some by now deep underwater, livestock bawling, drowning in rain, rain that kills the air, leaving only itself and more of itself. I can smell your skin on the good quilt, feel your baby swim hard in me, as if there were a river that led all the way to the sea.
The Great Flood, 1927. So in this section then, you know, for the poems that come from before you were born or, you know, had vivid memories of the events, how do you tap into and create that vivid image of the moment like you did in that poem?
Well, thank you. I did a lot of research. And I looked especially for firsthand accounts and for newspaper articles, and, you know, as I got a little further forward, I also found interviews. But for something like that, I read, and then there's the process of going from the general information to just really trying to imagine a specific person in a specific situation. And, you know, those characters, they just kind of showed up for me, which I appreciate, and they seem to have something to say. So a little bit of that process was the characters kind of emerging from that that combination of research and imagination.
Now, I like to be very selfish in requesting poetry, but I'll give you a chance to pick one that you would like to read for people.
Okay. I'm fine to follow your request. It's kind of curious for me to have someone else make it.
Oh, okay. Good. Good.
Why don't we go with you deserve to have your first choices. So what else would you like to hear?
Well, I'm going to go to the new section. I'd love for you to read Ice.
Okay. Ice. My brother says, it's bad. Snow, ice. Stay in Mexico. But I come anyway. Gadro's Dairy Farm. At least the double wide is warm. An old guy going home mumbles, enough is enough, and gives me his boots with rubber stars on the soles for the ice. Ice polishes the path to the barn. Ice grows a skin on the pond. Ice hangs from the roof like wolf teeth, hard and glistening. 14-hour days. 2 milkings. Every Saturday, I drive with the guys to town, and every time my brother says, stupid, don't go. Agents could be anywhere, in the grocery, the hardware store. Maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, but I go. I'm a man, not an animal to be tethered, to be milked.
What a perspective. And, you know, again, I don't think you're a migrant farm worker, you know, comes to work on a dairy farm from Mexico. But you provide a perspective that I don't really think about. And it really opened my eyes. But how did you get such a great first person account of what someone, you know, in that situation goes through while they're here in Vermont?
I mean, I think for this particular poem, I mean, my motivation was, you know, just my outrage at what the Immigration and Customs Enforcement version of ICE was doing. And so I, you know, because this is set in the present, I had the advantage of reading lots of first-person accounts of the experience of specifically working, you know, as a migrant worker in on a dairy farm. And then there's, you know, in terms of first person, you know, my hope was to be respectful because, as you say, this is not my experience.
Right.
So I really needed to write a poem that wasn't about migrant workers, that was just imagining a character.
Yeah.
And you know, hopefully it is in fact respectful. And, you know, even though I don't have that experience, I think when anybody writing creates a character, they draw on whatever experiences they do have that approximate what they want to write about. So, but for this, I did a lot of, I did all the reading I could so that I had a, you know, some sense, I can't possibly have the complete sense, but some sense of what that experience was like. And I really, as you know, as I said, I really also, I mean, this poem is as much about this person's, as much about ICE as it is about this person's experience for me.
Yep. Laura, do you have a chapbook handy or jotting down poems or ideas? Do you have a set time of the day or week that you write? How do you go about it?
Try to be pretty disciplined about having the same time of day for writing. So I'm not one of those. If I wait for the lightning of inspiration to strike, you know, it could be a dry spell for quite a while. And I find if I sit down, I hate the blank screen. I write on my computer. I hate the blank screen so much that I write something just so that there's letters in front of me.
Yep.
And so I need to be disciplined when I write. Doesn't mean that everything that I write is, you know, going to continue its life. Some of it is like, okay, I wrote that. Now I can, like, start writing something real.
Exactly.
And I, you know, if I'm really stuck, I read some of my favorite poets and get inspiration from that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask you, I mentioned earlier the book is divided into then and now. I'm going to hop back to the then section, and I'd love for you to read for everyone Bob Brown Recalls.
Oh, okay. I'm just going to say I'm really glad that you asked me to read that, because this is the one poem that is actually based on a person that I knew, and it was my across-the-street neighbor when I first moved onto my dirt road. He lived across the street, and he was such an unbelievably sweet man, and we used to talk a lot. And so I was thinking about him when I wrote this poem. Okay, this is Bob Brown Recalls, 1982. I used to walk the 13 miles from Starksboro every Saturday to court my bee. Her tongue was sharp as a skinning blade, even then, cut through most anything. Hands on hips, chin up the way a girl who isn't pretty learns. After I saw her beat the rugs in spring, I tossed my hat in first before entering her kitchen. Byron's moonshine still was down the road back then. God, that stuff was rough. Few things we had enough of. Work. Had enough of that. Cows, too. Nowadays, where's one young man knows his way around a three-horse plow? Not even my own boy, up to Burlington with that heating-cooling outfit. Keep thinking backward. Sunday picnics down by Black Plum Lake. Young ones running wild as turkeys. Hot bread, pork chops, rhubarb berry pie. Miss those days. Smell of hay cut me. Bee.
Oh, I love that so much.
Thank you. I love the people in it. So
yeah.
Thank you. I like it too.
Oh, gosh. Now, this yeah. I read at the beginning that New York Times review, which is massive. How did you react when you read that?
I was very tickled. And I only found out it was in New York because, a friend of my son had sent the text of it and said, is this person related to you? And so my son texted me. I said, where did you get that? And he's like, I don't know. So we started Googling around and he texted me back and said, oh, just a New York Times book review. So it was a total surprise for one thing. And I was very pleased, of course, because, my goal with this book is to have people read it. And I thought that would probably make a difference in how many people knew about it. That's kind of all I want is for people to read it.
Well, I'd be robbing people if I didn't let them hear one more, and this is another of my favorites. The Tears and Fears Cafe offers curbside pickup.
Okay. And the Tears and Fears Cafe shows up quite a bit, I would say, in the book.
Yes, it
does. It's my favorite cafe, even though it's imaginary. I actually sometimes wish I could actually go to it. Mm-hmm. This is the Tears and Fears Cafe offers curbside pickup. Dear loyal patrons, remember our sign's neon halo, our ancient tables with their fork-etched names, Ramona's voice, putting the whole town in its place, and the way our hard days turned to din, then song. Dear loyal patrons, remember Andre's grief soup, its lemon a narrow stairway to a tiny upstairs window, Max's one-sided noodles, how they swam in a sea of saffron like the past swims in tenuous laughter, how they dyed the town's tongues yellow, and Ramona's cake of Sundays, shy as a dove in springtime, restless at the first bite, but then fluttering its wings. Peace. Drink. Tonight, let the clink of the town's spoons sound in the unsure air.
I'm just thinking that there are people all over Vermont thinking, I think she's talking about our local cafe. I'm sure she
right.
is.
Right.
Laura, are you doing any readings locally?
Not up right now. I did have several fairly recently, but there's nothing on the slate right now.
All right. Well, please let us know. Poet Laura Badowski Wisniewski's new book is Sanctuary of Vermont. It's published by Orison Books, and you can visit laurabadowskiwisniewski.com to learn more about her work. Laura, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Rick. It's just been delightful talking with you.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you. All right, that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint was directed this morning by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast or subscribing at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we learn about Sanderson's Wooden Bowls, the St. J. Pet Parade, and Chat Acres Highland Beef.